Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, I don't know if you have been looking out your window today, but I certainly have. And the light has been extremely strange. Very much like the midway into a solar eclipse. For the late 90s and most of the 2000s, I was an eclipse chaser, and I think I probably went to 5 or 6 total solar eclipses. It's a bucket list thing, my friends, if you ever have the opportunity. It is, was for me, a spiritual experience, and the sensation of really seeing the sun for the first time. And the photos just don't do it. There are a few photographers who have learned how to digitally process to get something close to what it looks like. But in general, what you see with your naked eye is just amazing. And the camera doesn't come close. So I hope you will get the blessings of being able to travel again and see that experience. I believe there is one over the Western United States in a couple of years. So you might want to let's hope we can all travel at least that far by then. But my first action this morning when I saw that orange color to the sky and just the light, it's a sort of sunset light, but not quite, was to go to my handy-dandy air quality website, which is why I'm even talking about this, because there is an excellent government website that gives you a moment-by-moment air quality. And I'm looking at data that was updated today at 3 p.m., and it shows a thin little strip right along the coast of air that is good quality, and everything else is not so great. And this, I've watched this change from day to day. You can also, on this website, look at the actual particle count. There's a company called Purple Air that makes these little devices that are distributed all over the country. And so this data is coming from them. It reminds me of the story I covered last year where there was a digital thermometer and they had discovered they could predict flu outbreaks by looking at the rise of temperatures in a region. So the people would have their electronic thermometers and it reported to the cloud and they were able to pick up those early fevers. I presume they're still doing that. And it struck me as an interesting form of crowdsourced de-identified data. This is essentially the same thing, a little particle counter outside your porch, and you get to know what your local particle count is, and so does everybody else, which when you aggregate that data is awesome. The government's put that together. The website, I shall post a link on the notes for this program, but for those of you who are listening, it is GISPUB, G as in George, P as in Paul, GISPUB.EPA.gov/air now. And that will find it for you. It's excellent. And you can not just look at our own area. You can look all over the country. And in fact, if you shrink it enough, let's see, can you get all over the country? Yep, you can. So some pretty useful stuff. GISPUB.EPA.gov, and just check out the posting next week of this program at AskDrDawn.com for a link. I will also just comment, this is one of the best government-private industry collaborations I've seen, and it's really excellent. It's just go EPA. So I haven't been seeing too clearly today, but on the subject of seeing clearly, I had pulled this article from the August 11th issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it's about treatment of myopia. Now, myopia is nearsightedness, and nearsightedness is something that is extremely common in certain parts in the world. The frequency of nearsightedness in certain countries in Asia is extremely high, up to 80%. It's 50% in many parts of Europe. And the prevalence went from 25% in 1971 to 41% in the U.S. in 2004. Now, it turns out my grandma was right. She was always telling me when I was reading growing up that I should get a better light, that I was going to give myself the need for glasses. And I always thought that was a old wives' tale. I figured it was just hereditary because everyone in my family on my mom's side wore glasses. But it turns out that's not the truth. So let's talk about myopia. What is it? What causes nearsightedness? And the answer, oddly enough, is big eyeballs. The normal adult length of the eyeball, from the retina to the front of the lens, to the cornea, rather, so cornea to retina distance is about an inch, 22 to 25 millimeters. But in people with nearsightedness or myopia, they have at least 26 or greater. This is a very, very strange phenomenon because it develops as we grow. In normal development of the eye has to elongate, which involves restructuring the collagen so that the collagen can stretch. So the little cross links between the collagen fibers get broken and then regrown. And this turns out to be a hormonal process. In myopia, the growth continues beyond the normal length. And this is partially hereditary, but there's some other factors that I'm going to tell you about. The light rays, therefore, when the lens focuses them, when something's close, the lens can't focus them directly on the retina. Instead, the things are focusing behind the retina. And so it's blurry. It's just like a camera that's out of focus, if you've ever used one of those compound cameras that you can actually focus. So the light rays focus in front of the retina, and if you put on contact lenses, then the light rays will focus on the retina, and that's what my glasses do for me if I wear them, which is not very often. But what causes myopia, and why do we care? Well, obviously it's an inconvenience to wear glasses, but actually, pathologic myopia is a very serious thing. If the eyeball gets too big, you're at risk for all kinds of terrible eye diseases, including retinal detachment, which can permanently damage vision. The retinal tears come from, well, basically too much stretch on the surface of the retina because the eyeball is too big. You can also develop little holes or runs in the stocking of the retina, and this can lead to those retinal tears and to detachment. If you get a hole in the wrong place, you can get a hole right in the detailed macular vision, and that is very difficult to repair because the treatment is to take a laser beam and nail the retina back down. But the problem there is that every time you nail the retina, you've actually destroyed the sensors in that part of the retina. You can also get cataracts. You're at increased risk for macular degeneration, which obviously is another way that you blow that highly detailed macular vision, and you're at increased risk for glaucoma as well. So lots of reasons we would love to prevent myopia. And researchers over the years have discovered that there are environmental risk factors that involve near work at both long duration and also distances less than 12 inches, and a lack of outdoor exposure. High-intensity outdoor light seems to make a difference, and they think it's related to dopamine secretion because when you increase the dopamine, it inhibits the elongation of the eye. There's a recent study that was done in Asia where children were encouraged to go outdoors for up to 11 hours a week, and then they were tracked over a year, and there was less development of myopia. So getting the kids outside in bright daylight probably helps their sleep, but definitely helps their eye development. The question, in fact, some countries have already adopted this. I found a document online from the Singapore government, and you know, basically to the schools, saying, get those kids outside. We don't want them to get a problem. Another thing which works and is being looked at as a therapeutic intervention is very dilute atropine eye drops, and the concentrations of 0.01% to 1% have been used. And this is thought to work by upregulating retinal muscarinic receptors, that is a type of neurotransmitter receptor, and downregulating scleral receptors. And so this influences the sclera. The sclera is kind of the eyeball containing membrane, and it's very strong, and that's what holds the whole thing together. So it doesn't stretch as much if you hit it with atropine. There's also been some work having people wear contact lenses at night. And that's what this article that I'm going to tell you about, the study was called Blink, and it was reported in the issue of JAMA August 11th, 2020. And they enrolled, 292 randomized participants, an average age of 10. And they wore contact lenses, three different types, at night. One was just a corrective contact lens. One was a high correction, so one that essentially made the kids farsighted. So it was a magnifying lens, which would make them farsighted, and it led to a change in the internal signaling of the eyeballs. So over the course of 3 years, there was an improvement in the rate of change. Unfortunately, when the authors set the study up, they did the calculations and they thought that they had gotten enough people in it to reach statistical significance. But this is one of the tragedies of statistical significance, is that you can show a strong trend, which these studies did, without being able to show enough statistical significance to be considered a positive trial. Now, they did show statistical significance in with these different contact lenses, but it was only a trend. And I'm very excited, however, I have had myopia since I was 11, or at least actually probably earlier, but that's when it was discovered. And I would love to see us be able to identify it early through screening in children and prevent that, particularly if there's a history of high myopia. I really think it might be time for contact lenses, bright light therapy, and drugs to see if we can get enough synergy to actually cause, you know, it's essentially putting braces on the eyeball and having it actually work. Just amazing. We have an email. So let's take a look at that first email. It comes from Barry in Santa Cruz. Dear Dr. Don, we've been avoiding dining outside at restaurants or doing takeout. I wonder if you could give a rundown on the safety or lack of safety regarding either one of these activities during COVID-19. Thank you, and thanks for a fascinating and informative program. Sure, Barry. Let's do it as a rundown. So outdoors, 6 feet of distance, even better if they've got the little plexiglass dividers up, really does seem to be pretty safe. I have had no divider, socially distanced dinners with friends, one or two people who are in our sort of very small social bubble, because you got to be sane, and you have to, of course, be selective about who's in your bubble. But that being said, I do believe that those precautions are adequate. We are not seeing transmission that relates to people's behavior as far as eating out. And as long as you wash your hands and you're careful with that, takeout does not seem to be a problem. The restaurants have been doing a good job. And again, the contact tracers are not seeing that takeout food as a risk factor. So I think it is safe. I think you have to take a peek in the kitchen if you can, and make sure everyone's wearing a mask or hopefully the back door is open because they should be ventilating that kitchen. And you'll be able to just take a little peek and make sure that everyone you see is wearing a mask. It is, of course, in Santa Cruz County, very good compliance. Not always at the beach, but I have not seen a lot of people on the streets in downtown or in downtown Watsonville walking around without a mask on. I want to congratulate my community. And as long as the people who are preparing your food are wearing a mask and wash their hands, I really think we can relax about that. We know a lot more now than we did when this all got started. So I hope that helps. I am getting a little myopic and perseverative on the subject of COVID. I think many of us are. So I'm just going to give you a little bit of interesting COVID news because a lot happened in the last 3 days. So let's start with the manufacturer's announcement yesterday. And the biopharma leaders got together, and this is, I don't think this has ever happened. This happened Tuesday, that 9 CEOs of all of the vaccine manufacturing companies signed a historic pledge and put it out for the public. They've pledged to always make the safety and well-being of vaccinated individuals the top priority. They pledged to adhere to the scientific and ethical standards of the and not do any shortcutting, not do any shortcutting on the manufacturing process or the clinical trials, to only submit to the submit for emergency use authorization, that's those EUAs you hear about, after demonstrating safety and efficacy through a phase 3 clinical study. And I'm going to define what that would look like in a moment. They also promised to work to ensure a sufficient supply and range of vaccine options, including those suitable for global access. So just to talk a little bit about phase 3 trials, this is a study in which you give it to a lot of people, and you show that it prevents people from getting the disease. That's key. You prevent people from getting the disease. There's a lot of disease. There's a lot of countries or a lot of areas that still have a lot of disease. We could, for example, vaccinate college students, and we've got baseline data. We saw a great fall in those areas of people showing up and the case rate dropped, then that would be an indication that it's working. We could go down to, say, Brazil and vaccinate people and monitor them there. And it's still going to take a couple of years, probably, for us to know that it works. And that's a problem, obviously. But that's what they're saying, that they're going to do that. Is there a way to fast track it? Well, maybe, but the ethical and legal implications of this are pretty drastic. I noticed that companies are being, that the bill that is in the Senate right now would protect people from lawsuits if you're a business. I'm not sure that that would work for Big Pharma, who's creating vaccines, but it would definitely work for employers or restaurants where you went there and got COVID. So you may not be able to hire a lawyer if things don't go well. But you could hire people who are young and healthy and low risk, and you could swab the inside of their nose with COVID-19, because that's how they do it in animals. And that's what the vaccine manufacturers did way back in probably February, once they could get their hands on virus, and they found that their vaccine was working in animals, and they went forward to start testing it and start making it. And that's the intelligent way to proceed, and I have no problem with that. The question is whether it's ethical, given the death rate from this disease, and the fact that we do seem to have gotten a handle on it with masking and hand washing, whether we really need to endanger people's lives or put them at risk of long-term health problems for money. And obviously, the people who would sign up on such a deal would be people who are desperate. So there's also definitely a sense that we might be taking advantage of an already vulnerable group. So that was interesting. The other interesting thing that happened was that there was a pause on one of the vaccines. This is one of the ones I liked. It was Oxford and AstraZeneca, and they were in phase three, starting to enroll people in that trial, and there was the second adverse event. The first adverse event that they had didn't stop the trial because they were sure, and I don't know how because this are proprietary results, that it wasn't related to the vaccine. And I don't know how they knew that, but they did not. I can't even guess. The second one, this is an adverse event. We don't know when it happened. We don't know how serious it was, but they paused the enrollment of the trial. So those who've already received the vaccine have received the vaccine, but they're not adding any more people until they do more investigation. And I think this is a really good example of that due diligence I was talking about just a moment ago and why it's so important to look for that due diligence. And one less kind of salacious, and this is where the public confidence kind of goes out the window a little bit for me. I've always been a little nervous about the Moderna vaccine. That's no secret to you. It's a novel approach. It has not ever been done successfully. And so that makes you a little nervous. This, I just learned, makes me even more nervous, which is that the executives, many of the executives at this company have actually sold all of their stock. The chief medical officer has divested himself of all the stock he owns. The CEO and the president have both sold millions of dollars worth of stock. And the question is, if they have confidence in their product, would they be selling off? And do they know something we don't know? And there are also some minor technical irregularities about how that stock was sold that I won't bother you with, but it's fishy. And so maybe, but it's fishy. And I have to wonder, with this other thing coming out, whether this particular smoke is connected to fire. Can't say. Just wonder. Let's go to our email here. This from Neil in Warsaw, Poland. What a lovely city. I really enjoyed visiting that many years ago, and I'm sure it's just as nice as it was then. Efficacy of vitamin D in treating COVID. Dear Dr. Don, we follow your valuable advice via podcast. It's always interesting and very practical. I'm sure you have a busy life, but I thought you might be interested in the video on this link. He's a no-nonsense Brit doctor posting regular reports on COVID, but this one and the Spanish research it describes is a real shocker, but potentially in a very hopeful way. So I have that article, and we're going to talk about it. This was, first of all, let me give you the setup. This was done in Spain at the Reina Sofia University Hospital, and it was done a few months ago. When you see the protocol, you'll understand why I emphasize that. 76 consecutive patients hospitalized with, they had acute respiratory infection, they had a X-ray positive for viral pneumonia, and they had a positive SARS-CoV PCR. And they had a severity scale that got them into the hospital. All people admitted to the hospital received the same therapy, a combination of hydroxychloroquine. I won't go into the dosing, but they treated people for 5 days. Azithromycin for 5 days. This is essentially the Didier Raoult protocol that came out of France. And they had two groups, right? Both groups got that, but one group was randomized to receive high-dose vitamin D. And this was a electronic randomization. It's prospective in the sense that they came in, they got an electronic randomization. It was therefore random. So So it's possible with such a small number of people that you might accidentally get sicker people in the placebo group, and there's no way to know that. But of the 50 patients who were treated with vitamin D, and I'll give you the doses in a moment, they are big, there was a big improvement. So they were given 20,000 IU of vitamin D on admission, and 20,000 on the day of admission, and then 10,000 2 days later, and 10,000 more 2 days after that. Now, this was given orally, and we know that this oral doses at this level can rapidly raise the serum level. What they found is really interesting. Of the 50 patients treated with vitamin D, one needed to go to the ICU. That's 2%. While of the 26 untreated patients, 13 required admission to the hospital. That gives a really substantial odds ratio of 0.02. So you are way less likely, you know, 1 out of 50 versus 13 out of 26. So 50 times higher risk of ICU admission. Some of that could be randomization. It's hard to believe all of it. Of the patients treated with vitamin D, none died and all went home without complications. Two of the people admitted to the ICU died, and the remaining 11 did go home. So it's a pilot study. Larger trials are needed. But we've already seen recently, and I believe it was last week we talked about, the fact that when you look at blood levels of vitamin D at admission and then track how those patients do throughout their hospital stay, the people who have low vitamin D are sicker when they hit the door, they stay in the hospital longer, and there seems to be pretty strong evidence that vitamin D is protective. And of course, in shutdown, we've all been sitting in caves. So please get your vitamin D level checked. And if you have a low vitamin D level, start supplementing. I have been doing vitamin D levels in my practice for over a decade, and I am always surprised, probably because many of my patients work in Silicon Valley, how low those levels are. So thank you, Neil, for the article. Actually, I call them my posse, which are the people who send me articles that they think I might find interesting to share with the audience. I love it. It makes this a bigger community, helps me feel a little less lonely, and God knows we could all use that right now. Let's talk with Aileen. Hello, Aileen. Do I have your name pronounced correctly?
Aileen. It's French, Aileen. But I'm not.
Oh, well,
short
you
A,
know.
Long E accent on the second syllable. Namesake for my great aunt.
Oh, wonderful.
She didn't have any
wonderful
kids. She was infertile. But, it was some three Wednesdays ago that I called. Doctor, is your last name your name? Is it Greek?
Actually, it's Polish.
Oh, okay.
it's the Polish word for hoe, like as in the gardening implement.
Yes, indeed.
And they pronounce it in Poland, motyka.
Motyka, I like
motyka.
That.
So whenever I told people my name in Poland, they're like, they would giggle.
Yeah, really.
Because it was a weird pronunciation.
Yeah. Well, speaking of names, you mentioned you were talking about femur bones and fractures last week.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I, 5 years, when went to 2015 up at the Quaker meeting, Quaker Center up in Ben Lomond, and I fell in such a way that I fractured close to, the femur bone, yeah.
Now, was that close to the hip or was that in the middle of the bone?
The middle, way down.
Okay. And was this did you fall from a height? Like you were on a scaffolding or a ladder?
Hit it on they've paved it since then, but some awful gravel that I
so you were,
on
so you slipped point. From, you were simply standing and you slipped.
I was walking down the gravel road.
Right. I've done that. I've
but
done that.
But usually that we would land on our butts, on our hips. Mm-hmm. But I didn't land on my hips.
Well, you may have caught a rock just right and gotten a karate chop, but it does raise the risk for osteoporosis. Have you been checked?
Not yet.
Oh, they should have done that. They should have done that.
No, you should have a bone scan.
Okay.
And what they'll do is they'll take, they'll use two frequencies of X-ray, and one of them goes through the bone at a different rate, kind of like a different amount of the X-ray passes through the bone, and then they can figure out how dense the bone is based on how well it absorbs the X-rays. And this is a focusing technique that they use. I don't know the technical aspects of it, but it's pretty accurate for bone density.
Well, and ever since menopause, and I'm 71 now, I've been taking, my doctor did put me on high-dose vitamin D.
What does high dose mean?
800.
That's not high dose. That's, but you don't need to worry about that. Your vitamin D level should be checked.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not at least 40, I use that as my bottom. By the way, the normal vitamin D used to be 20. And when I was in medical school, they taught me, oh, don't give too much vitamin D. It's really dangerous. You know, you'll cause hepatitis. And you won't. You can give really big doses of vitamin D. Now, this mid-shaft fracture thing I was talking about is rare. And it's become more common since people have taken bisphosphonates, which are a type of drug that's supposed to prevent osteoporosis. Did you by any chance get put on bisphosphonates at menopause? Okay.
No.
And so even though you've been on vitamin D, I really do think you should have a blood level done, and that's very widely available. You can probably just, I'm not sure whether you have to call your doctor or whether you have whether they have an email portal or however it is that you communicate with your primary care doctor, just ask them to order it. And I'm sure they will.
I have a darling new generation Chinese-American doctor, Dr. Victoria Chu. But then in the telephone book in the San Jose, there's about 8 dentists, Dr. Chu, C-H-U.
Well, it's probably not nearly as funny in Chinese as it is in spoken English.
Beyond that, well, the surgeon, I was so thrilled when I was had to go to emergency for the fracture 5 years ago. And they gave me low dose morphine or something else. I can't remember. It was something else, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And this woman comes in, and she wasn't wearing a uniform or anything. And I said, "Oh, you look like an East Indian movie star."
Oh.
And she's gone on to go to Hawaii. She loved to surf. I wondered if you ever knew Dr. Rosie Sender.
No, I didn't.
Punjabi,
I probably.
Indian.
You know, it's wonderful.
Well, she's a new generation East Indian surgeon.
Well,
we're
working.
She grew up in school in Canada.
Let me ask you if you had any other questions.
I do remember tuning in and hearing you some time ago, and about cholesterol, and I was so glad to hear about that, and I told Dr. Chu I'm not going to take them anymore after age 70. You said something about cholesterol medicine being bad for people after age 70.
Yes, you were talking about statins.
There are a couple of reasons not to take it, and the benefit is vanishingly small if you have gotten to 70 without a heart attack. So that's the thing. It's all context. And so there's no such thing as one-size-fits-all medicine.
Right, right.
Any more than there's one-size-fits-all pantyhose.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for the call, and please keep listening. If you have any other questions, feel free to call next week.
Well, I know you're tight for time. I just wanted to hear again about the cholesterol medicine being... You mean it can cause heart attacks?
No, it actually doesn't cause heart attacks, but it can contribute to Alzheimer's and muscle weakness and nerve damage in general.
God, right.
So we don't want that.
Right.
We don't want any of those things.
Right. Yeah, so I told her I wasn't going to take anymore, and she said, okay.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Doctor. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Our next story is about a new natural treatment that may prove to be
game-changing in breast cancer, particularly triple-negative breast cancer, which is one of the ones that is the most difficult to treat. This research comes out of Perth, Western Australia, and the doctor is Chiara Duffy from the Harry Perkins Institute of Medical Research and the University of Western Australia. And this work was published in Precision Oncology recently, and it shows that honeybee venom rapidly destroyed triple-negative breast cancer and also what are called HER2-enriched breast cancer cells. This type of cancer is generally treated with Taxol or its derivatives, but has a tendency to recur and is aggressive and spreads early. So we're always trying to find breast cancer before it spreads, because once the, you know, once the horse has left the barn, it's difficult to get it back inside. So they tested honeybee venom on, first of all, on normal breast cells and cells from the different clinical types of breast cancer, the estrogen receptor positive, progesterone receptor positive, the HER2 new positive, and the triple negative, meaning that none of those receptors were found. They were looking at a very small peptide. That's a chain of amino acids, kind of a baby protein, and it's called melanin. It's found in honeybee venom, but they can reproduce it synthetically, and they found that both the synthetic product and the honeybee venom worked and showed strong and potent anti-cancer effects. Now, part of the study was done in vitro, that means to say in a artificial environment of just cells growing in culture medium. And when they gave a specific concentration of the honeybee venom, they got 100% cancer cell death, but minimal effects and no death of normal cells. The melanin can completely destroy the cancer cell membranes within 60 minutes. And in fact, within 20 minutes, they were able to show that the chemical messages of cancer cells that are essential for growth and cell division had stopped. They were looking at how melanin and honeybee venom worked on these signaling pathways, and the pathways were shut down very quickly, particularly the activation of a receptor that's overexpressed in triple-negative breast cancer, something called epidermal growth factor receptor. And it also suppressed the activation of HER2 new by the, so that's an incredibly useful thing. The other thing they found was that this melanin could be used with existing chemotherapy drugs because it forms pores in the cell membranes of these breast cancers and allows the chemotherapy drug to enter. So they used a combination of melanin and docetaxel in mice. And they were, so that's good because we go from the petri dish to an animal model and we show that you can achieve the kind of blood levels that you would need in order to be able to use this clinically. And melanin, if you want to look it up, is spelled melittin. It is not related to melatonin, more is the pity, although people in the natural world do use high-dose melatonin, about 20 milligrams a day, for the management of breast cancer, and there is some data in actual humans that shows that this is beneficial. But it's small studies and fraught because it's not an actionable thing from a drug company to try to do this. Still, extremely interesting. This also goes way back. Nature, the very famous journal of science, published the first studies of bee venom therapy in 1950, and bee venom there was being used to reduce the growth of plant tumors. But over the last decade or so, it's working on it for human and animal cancers is, I think, just fascinating. So some more interesting technology. So put on your thinking cap. We're about to fix dyslexia with a helmet. This study was published yesterday in PLOS Biology. It is peer-reviewed, and it comes out of the University of Geneva. Dyslexia is found in about 10% of the population, and it is a situation of lifelong difficulties with understanding written material. Now, we've gotten so good at looking inside the brain that we now understand that the predominant problem is what's called a phonological deficit, that is, a difficulty in processing language sounds. This deficit is associated with changes in rhythmic or repetitive patterns of neural activity, something called the low gamma oscillation, in the sound processing region of the brain called the left auditory cortex. So the part of your brain that processes speech is actually quite active when you read. It's as if you are narrating what you read to yourself, or at least using that same circuitry. So the researchers thought, what if we were to stimulate that low gamma oscillation in the auditory cortex? And they built a device that would do that. And they used transcranial alternating current stimulation, which is a thing. This could probably also be done with magnetic stimulation, but this was a study doing electrical stimulation. And they had 15 adults with dyslexia and 15 fluent readers. The fluent readers and the dyslexics were treated for 20 minutes, and then they were asked to read something. There was immediate improvement in processing and reading accuracy in the dyslexics. But here's what's really interesting. You have to dial it in at the right frequency. 30 hertz, but not 60 hertz stimulation worked. Now, the worse you were at your reading, the better an effect you had. But I thought this was really interesting because I am a very good reader. This actually interfered with processing in very good readers, probably because it created a distortion, kind of like speaker feedback or something along those lines. So pretty fascinating about that. We're going to another email, and I want to actually reference an email that we received last week also from Elizabeth, who used the On Air at KSQD to write to me during the show. So I was kind of having to work with not much time to do a lot of research, but I misunderstood her question. This was about an air filter device that isn't really a filter, but is a heater. And the idea is that it sucks things in and it heats it, and that this would, her question was whether it would have an effect on dust and mold. And I guess I didn't understand the question because I answered the question about whether it would kill COVID. And that wasn't her question. The question was about dust and mold. And I had another email this week asking about air filters and whether they're worth the money. So I thought I would combine these two. But I'm first going to address a clarification for Elizabeth and say that the heating device that you were asking about would not have, I think, a benefit for dust. And maybe cat dander and dust probably would not be burnt up completely, that you couldn't react to them. And I'd really want to see trial data or something from an independent lab. With respect to mold, it would probably kill mold. The question is open, I think, whether it would disrupt mold toxins. Now, mold toxins and mold antigens are peptides, essentially. They're strings of amino acids. But I think that it would have to be specifically studied to know for sure if it would actually prevent mold allergies or attenuate mold toxins. So I'm going to essentially say you probably do better with a HEPA filter. And this question now to Mary in Santa Cruz with respect to, is a HEPA filter worth the money? And I guess the answer is, it depends. Now, the portable air cleaners that we're talking about work by filtering out this airborne particles, and most of them will clean all particles they'll get like 95% of, let's see, 99.97% percent of airborne particles the size of 0.3 microns, and of course even more if they're bigger, and that's pretty darn good. You want to look at the virus is only 0.1 micron in size, so you'd think that it would fit through the filter, but you've probably seen the images. The virus is released through in goo. It's already been covered with nasal mucus or respiratory mucus, and so the droplets that come out are generally much bigger, more on the size of 1 to 3 microns. And so virus is never alone. It's never just on its own floating around in the environment. Thank God. It is in goo. So how important is it? It kind of depends on whether you can keep the windows open. If you're going to buy a portable air cleaner, you want to get one that filters 300 cubic feet per minute. And that's about it. You don't really need an ozonator. You can find a good one for around $250. You can actually find good ones still at the secondhand stores. I was up at Abbott's Habit in our lovely Ben Lomond before the fires and saw two for sale there. Went back and bought one of them, and somebody else had snagged the other. But those are proud place now in my office, the acupuncture side, as well as my office where I spend all day. But on my acupuncture side, it's important because people spend 30 to 45 minutes inside in a room, and the soft, muted rumble of the air filter is kind of relaxing. It's sort of a white noise generator, so it hasn't been a problem for them. If you have kids who come back from college, if you have relatives who come and stay in your house, if you live in a household where there maybe are 3 or 4 different people, some of them working, some not, then you really might want to consider putting that filter in near the person who is most likely to have germs. And certainly if someone gets sick with COVID and has to isolate or has a suspected case of COVID, these are people that you really want to maybe have an air filter for. They're worth looking for. And so that's my recommendation. It's turning out to be a tech show. So let's keep going with the tech because there's lots of good tech this week. This has, oh God, what was that? Ready Player One was a wonderful movie based on a great book. And in that, these young people lived in a kind of virtual game reality, and they wore these suits that were total body suits that read their movements and mimicked them in the virtual space, but also gave them the sensation of touch. We've made another step forward. Engineers have invented, this is New South Wales, a wearable glove that could obviously be turned into a body glove that simulates the sense of touch. The device has a bunch of tiny little virtual muscles in it. So imagine a wetsuit that could give you a massage, and I think you're pretty close to what they've got here. The muscles are strong enough to push on the hand and generate the sensation of touch and shear force, which is the drag when you run your finger across something. The skin, you get a touch sensation, but you also get a stretch sensation, and it's the direction of the stretch that tells you which way your hand is moving. They've been able to create a device that allows people to feel remote objects or virtual objects, and the implication for this, it's pretty wide. It feels like you're wearing a second skin and could be pretty comfortable. I don't know about breathability. Certainly walking around with a wetsuit all day would not be so much fun. They're thinking about telehealth. I'm wondering about whether I could do an abdominal exam using the glove. How hard could I push? Could I feel the liver? Medical devices, surgical robots. Now, that's a place where I think it really could be beneficial because a lot of places, you just can't get a doctor in there, but you might be able to have someone hook up to a machine and drive the robot, so to speak, remotely. Right now, that's done in the room with the robot, but doing it over the internet opens up a whole new level of expertise for treatment. Perhaps you have the most skilled brain surgeon for this particular type of surgery working on you through a robot, rather than having to, you know, take the pretty good but not the best person who is available to you wherever you happen to be. Other operations I'm thinking about, you know, sending the robot in to pick up the radioactive material at Fukushima, all sorts of other things. And of course, sex dolls, because, hey, you've heard of phone sex. Well, it may actually be that we will have virtual virtual sex or telesex through the internet in the not too distant future, because there's a market for that. What a strange and crazy world we live in, my friends. Just really strange and crazy. We're coming very close to the top of the hour. So I want to figure a story that will not take us over the edge. Sometimes I get excited, and I certainly don't want to do that. So let's talk about using fat transplants to lose weight. Actually, we'd be transplanting back your own fat. This is research coming out of Joslin Diabetes Center. It's a proof of concept study that's not ready for prime time yet. But basically what they did was extract human fat cells from subjects and use CRISPR to modify them so that they were acting more like brown fat. Specifically, what they did was increase the expression of a gene called UCP1. And this triggers the white fat stem cells to develop into brown fat stem cells. They don't turn into full-blown brown fat stem cells, but what they do in mice is help them lose weight and prevent them from becoming diabetic when they're fed a diet that should induce diabetes in mice. But it's not because these were turning into brown fat cells. It's because of signaling. These Franken cells, if you will, were able to turn on the endogenous brown cells. And they did that apparently by secreting nitric oxide, another signaling molecule that's turning out to be extremely important in science. So it's a long way before prime time, but won't that be interesting if we are able to just make you have a quote unquote higher metabolism? Theoretically possible. Stay tuned for more. I hope you've enjoyed this show as much as I have. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, stay safe, and stay healthy. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long, and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.